As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome. This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, where each week myself, Ali Maxwell, and the Athletic's tactics guru, Michael Cox, tackle a topic related to football tactics, tactical trends, and more often than not, we apply a dusting of data insight as well. As ever today, I'm joined by the man I call the Dennis Irwin of the Football Tactics Pod family. Reliable, available, dependable, cheap, and effective. Hello, Michael Cox. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for that comparison. I once played football against Dennis Irwin, actually, about 3 years ago. And despite being about 50, he was still really, really good. I mean, eye-openingly superior to everyone else on the pitch. It was genuinely a great experience.
Why do professionals always have so much more time on the ball? Why do they look like they're playing in slow motion?
It is remarkable. Even, 15 years after he retired, he was just able to pull the strings, you know, as effectively as any player I've ever been on a football pitch with. It was, like I say, quite a memorable experience.
Did you get to see him take a pen?
No penalties. No, he did just turn past me with incredible ease, in part because, of course, you could go left foot or right foot, couldn't he? So I tried to close him down and he just went past me like a prime Messi. It was fantastic.
I always have him pegged as just a real sort of penalty merchant, but actually 5 non-penalty goals in the 92-93 season, the inaugural Premier League season. Very impressive stuff.
Yeah, free kicks as well. He was decent at blasted free kicks, wasn't he?
Absolutely. You've had a busy weekend of football watching and writing. On Manchester City, you saw them in the flesh, I believe, and you were quite taken, particularly by their first half performance. You wrote Guardiola's side producing among the most dominant 45-minute periods you'll witness in the Premier League.
Yeah, they were brilliant. I mean, it was one of those games where you expect Manchester City to win. But they were, I mean, just the level of possession was incredible. They won the ball back so quickly. The movement and interplay from effectively the front five was fantastic. I thought Grealish was quite promising, actually, in the central forward role. And yeah, I was kind of sitting towards the end. They were attacking in the first half and it was one of those games where you kind of just become slightly mesmerised and you look at the clock and you're amazed it's half an hour in because you haven't really taken your eyes off the action. It was, not a massive win, 3-1, but the performance in the first half was as good as I've seen City for quite a while.
And also you wrote a breakdown of the Women's FA Cup final, which was on Sunday, Chelsea the victors. And you took a quick look at how Godfather Ralph, as I'm now calling him after last week's episode, about how he approached things in the Old Trafford dugout for the first time. Quick first impressions?
Yeah, kind of what you'd expect from a pressing manager, I think. You know, they come in and they focus so much on regaining the ball that I think sometimes the players are slightly tired when the ball's been won, or maybe they don't quite have the ideas and the pictures of what they're supposed to do with it. But there were some encouraging signs in terms of how well they won the ball. The attacking quality, I'm sure, will come at a later date.
thankfully, it's not just me and you on the pod this week. We've given it the longest build-up we possibly can to introduce a debutant on the podcast. John Muller joins us. John is a senior writer for The Athletic, and he specialises in data analytics in football. John, you've been with The Athletic for a couple of weeks. You're now on the Football Tactics pod. Great to have you on board. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy to make my debut here.
Of course, you've been head down for the last few weeks. You've already churned out some really interesting pieces. How are you settling in? Because you've been writing about analytics in football for some time now, but dare I say it, perhaps not quite on this scale and maybe not with quite as heavy a workload as you must have now.
Scale is the right word. It's interesting to work with a lot of other writers as well as just doing my own stuff. But it's good to get those extra perspectives.
Of course, previously you were you had a newsletter called Space. Is it three spaces? How many spaces was
that? Three spaces. You got it.
Three spaces. And I must admit, I had noticed this, but I had it confirmed by someone even more in the know in the data in football writing community this week, that when it comes to what he described as big ticket pieces, John is the man. And I know that on your previous home, the Space newsletter, there was so much good stuff on there, among which was the big book of build-ups about build-up play, the seven styles of soccer, and also an amazing piece on midfield personality types. So first and foremost, albeit you've written plenty of pieces already for The Athletic, if anyone wants to read more about what you're about, that's an amazing way to spend a few hours on the Space newsletter archive, which is free for all now. But thank you for joining us, and we're going to tackle your topic that you've just released a piece on today. Michael, it does mean we're talking about fullbacks again. Oh boy, do we love fullbacks, from the least sexy position on the football pitch probably to potentially the sexiest in footballing terms and tactical terms, or all in the space of what, 15 years or so?
Yeah, I think especially this season. We were doing a fun little exercise at The Athletic last week where we were all asked to name who we thought the best 10 players in the Premier League were at the moment. And I had both Alexander-Arnold and Cancelo in there. And it probably haven't been many years where I would have said there's two fullbacks in the best players. But like you say, we've done a few podcasts about fullbacks in recent months. But I mean, John's article was really interesting. It used data to show something that I hadn't really thought you'd be able to use data to show your workings. But yeah, really interesting piece on underlapping runs from fullbacks. And statistically, there has been a very significant rise in that kind of run over the last couple of years. I suppose it depends how you interpret the graph, but certainly compared to 2014, there's been a huge rise.
That's right, John. A big ticket piece. The title is The Rise of the Underlap. Just talk us through it first and foremost. What were you hoping to discover or uncover perhaps in writing this piece?
So the piece started off in my notes called The Death of the Overlap, which was, of course, grandiose and ridiculous. But, I think that anybody who watches the game closely has noticed that fullback play has gotten more varied in recent years, and not just at the top of the game, but throughout the Premier League. We've seen different kinds of behaviors, not just the traditional inverted winger dribbling inside, fullback overlaps around the outside, but a variety of things. And I didn't necessarily want to try to measure everything that fullbacks do in one article, because that might have been a little much. But when I found that I could, using proxies, get at this shift from 90% overlapping runs to more of like an 80-20 split, that's a pretty significant shift in the last 5, 6, 7 years. And I thought that was really interesting and worth digging into.
Michael, as I read the piece, it struck me that there's definitely a period of time where if you were trying to explain to someone how, let's say, an average Premier League team plays or how they like to attack, you could probably describe their attacking play by saying something like inverted wingers providing a goal threat and some creativity as well, and fullbacks providing the width. But you can't just copy and paste that anymore, right? Because that's not always the case.
Yeah, there's lots of different variations. I think we've seen more examples of real, very wide wingers. I mean, that's what Manchester City were doing, at Watford in particular. Sterling and Foden were really hugging the touchlines almost and going down the outside in a way that I don't think you saw that much of maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And of course, that means the fullbacks can't overlap. And there's different ways that you can then use your fullbacks. I mean, Guardiola, I think, is the most renowned manager in terms of the fullbacks coming quite central and being midfielders. But if there's a more direct attack in particular, I think, you know, even without looking at John's very good piece of the data, I think it's obvious that we have seen a rise in fullbacks bursting through on the inside into that channel, which is, I think, quite a difficult run for opponents to track. Mm.
And it just means that the broad church of football tactics gets broader, that the variety that it adds is very welcome, certainly to my eyes. You've written a lot, Michael, recently, by which I mean in the last year or two, about teams attacking with a front five, basically all the top teams doing so in some manner, but often in a different way. And the fullbacks are a big part of this, right? Because sometimes there's one or two fullbacks in that front five, or wing backs, perhaps I should say, in some cases. And sometimes there's one or maybe even neither of them in that front five.
Yeah, I mean, often they're, you know, if you look at Liverpool, they're often overlapping to become the wide attackers with Alexander-Arnold and Robertson, very good crossers. But certainly there are examples, maybe not necessarily as a side's default attacking shape, but certainly there are examples that John highlighted, particularly from Robertson, where he's becoming really the inside left and Mane is peeling wide and slipping him in. I think that was one of the most interesting statistical takeaways from John's piece, that when you get what he called a diagonal ball to an underlapping fullback, the probability of a goal is quite significantly higher to the other three types of passing identified.
Michael's alluded to it here. In the process of writing this piece, in the process of attempting to measure this, which is your job, you ended up with four categories, four sort of buckets in terms of overlapping and underlapping runs that fullbacks make.
That's right. So one of the challenges here was that I'm working with event data, which tells you when and where things happen on the ball, but doesn't actually show you who's making a run off the ball. And so what I wanted to do was try to figure out what might be a reasonable proxy to get at how fullbacks were moving relative to their teammates. So I used kind of a four-square grid around the corner of the box. And so passes that originated in the half space and went out to the wing either went diagonally forward up in the direction of the corner flag, or they went sideways to a fullback who was just kind of parallel with a winger or midfielder on the wing at the corner of the box. And same thing with passes that originated from the wing. Either they went sideways to a fullback who's in the half space, kind of in that area that Cancelo has loved to occupy lately, or to someone like in the opening example of the piece, Robertson runs all the way past the center back and fullback and receives a ball diagonally from the wing to the touchline inside the box.
So within the four buckets that we end up with, diagonal overlaps and lateral overlaps, I think these are still, even though the focus of the piece was the rise of the underlap, these are still the more popular fullback attacking movements. And I think they're ones that we're all pretty au fait with. But when it comes to the underlaps, just talk me through what ended up as the definition of a lateral underlap and a diagonal underlap.
Sure. So part of the challenge here was that because I don't have data on where fullbacks go when they don't get the ball, we're only using those cases where they do get the ball as proxies for kind of what kind of movements they're making in general. So completed passes sideways from the wing to a fullback who's in the half space are kind of the big driver of this rise in underlaps. And of course, a lot of that is coming from Manchester City, who do this routinely. But a lot of it is also coming from teams that don't necessarily, you know, park a fullback all the way up in the attacking third, and work that channel on a consistent basis. But fullbacks are coming in and making those dynamic runs more often than they used to.
Michael, just paint a picture for us in your brain, having read that piece, looking at particularly lateral underlaps and diagonal underlaps, which players and which teams spring to mind?
The first one I thought of actually was, this is going back a long time, but I remember when I first watched Marcelo Bielsa's Chile side in the build-up to the 2010 World Cup. They did that a lot that I'd never really seen before. So as always with Bielsa, he played a front three, stretched very far across the pitch. And the fullbacks, I think the one on the right was Mauricio Isla, and the left side of one was probably Beausejour.
Beausejour, yeah, surely.
Who would just, because they were such a direct team, Chile, at a time when international football was either A, quite defensive, or B, very possession-based. Just watching the fullbacks storm forward into the channels, into goal-scoring positions, I'd never really seen anything like it. And I probably haven't seen that many teams who put such emphasis on that. But I think we've mentioned Liverpool already in terms of Robertson underlapping Mane. But Sheffield United as well. I mean, people used to talk about the overlapping centre-backs. I mean, we're dealing with a different position here because they were part of a back three. But actually, they used to make underlapping runs as well, which is odd because the wide players were effectively the wing-backs because they played two up front. So that was quite an odd situation, but it worked very well for them. Whether you can count that as underlapping, I don't know. Maybe they started in a narrow position already. In European terms, I think of Atalanta, who are all about the rotations down the flanks. Although they do it with wing-backs, the wing-backs are coming inside rather than it being full-backs. So I don't think they were included in John's categorization.
That's right. For data purposes, I only looked at full-backs and back fours. I think that wing-backs present some kind of similar and some different issues, and I wanted to treat those separately.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. John, you mentioned, and it's, you know, it's the crux of the piece, that this is something that we will have noticed with our own eyes, particularly watching Manchester City and Liverpool as well. You mentioned at the top of the pod that we're probably looking at this, the instances of these runs being made probably doubling over the last 5 or 6 years. Is it the case that they are still increasing? Do you think that that share, the proportion of underlapping runs versus overlapping runs from fullbacks, will continue to rise?
So at least for the seasons where we have data for a full season, the trend has been really sharp and really consistent for the last 7 years, since 2014-15, when overlapping behavior was about 90% of the completed passes in our data set. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that overlaps are 90% of the runs, because it is frequently easier to complete a pass to a player who's making an overlapping run than one who's making an underlapping one. Yeah. But from that 90-10 peak in 2014-15, almost every season, we've seen a steady increase so that we're close to 80-20. Now, this season, it is actually slightly down from last season, but, you know, who knows when we get to the end of the season what that'll look like.
I enjoyed, as ever, reading some of the comments below the line. There are a couple of people whose headline was, "Nothing new this, John, nothing new." One wrote, "Baines and Pienaar were doing this for Everton 10 years ago, lads. Nothing new." Just the one name on the byline there. Not sure we needed lads, to be honest. We also had, "How had Bournemouth doing this 10 plus years ago? Nothing new." Again, that phrase cropping up again. Ashley Coles mentioned as well. And it made me laugh, John, because I don't think at any point it was suggested that this had never happened before, but rather that it's happening a hell of a lot more.
Yeah, when a game is 150 years old, it's very hard to do something that nobody has ever done before. And I certainly wasn't claiming that was the case here. Even at its peak, you know, we were still seeing 10% underlapping runs. So this was something that lots of teams have done in the past. What's interesting is that across the league, that share has nearly doubled, like you said, in the last 7 years. And I think it was interesting also to look at sort of the outcomes of these different runs, both offensively and defensively, and why that shift might be happening.
Hey, talking about things that haven't been done in 150 years of the game, Michael, did you see Bournemouth's goal against Fulham on Friday night from kickoff? They scored a goal within 7 seconds of kickoff. And I know we mentioned once a very famous Leipzig goal that they scored from kickoff, which you can find on YouTube, which is a great watch. It's more akin to like a rugby kickoff or even an NFL style kickoff than anything else. Bournemouth, to a greater extent than I've ever seen before, performed a set piece routine from kickoff that ended with Solanke firing home 10 yards out one-on-one with the keeper after 7 seconds. And it was off the top of my head, you know, short pass backwards, short pass front left to someone, and then setting the ball back for Billing, the central midfield player. During that, Solanke had just got on his bike and sprinted, and the timing was just so perfect. Billing's ball had to be perfect because it was essentially just a straight ball through the two centre-backs or over the top of them into the path of Solanke. I think that had to be mentioned on this pod this week because it's not something I'd seen before. And it as you can imagine, it caused some amount of delight.
It gives me bad flashbacks of when I remember playing for my school football team when I was about 10, and our manager gave us basically a set piece from centre, which was nothing more than a player launching it diagonally for a winger, really. But I remember he said, "If everything goes to plan, we'll only need to use this once all game." And we ended up needing to use it 10 times because we lost 9-3. the set piece had increasingly less relevance once the opposition had worked out what we were going to do every time.
Just shows what you can do with a little bit of creativity. Shows what you can get from that. You know, it's a lot more imaginative, isn't it, Michael, than just pumping it into the corner for a throw and then boxing them in, which we know you really, really don't like.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, that is a rugby move, I would expect. Yeah.
This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. We're talking this week about the increased variety of attacking movement from fullbacks. Incredibly on brand. I'm with Michael Cox and John Muller. Next up, we'll hear about some of the trailblazers on this front.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, John, we've established from the comments section, helpful as always, that yes, some fullbacks have attacked inside rather than outside before in football's history. But in terms of this noticeable increase, the start of a trend, if you will, that you've written about, is there quite an obvious starting point? Can we trace this back to some time or someone, perhaps?
So it's tempting, of course, to say that Pep arrived in the league and everything changed. And certainly that's a big part of this. But the trend seems to start upward about two seasons before Guardiola got to the Premier League. So, you know, tactics ideas cross continents, arrive with different coaches. They rise and fall naturally in every league over time. So I would say that really 2014-15 seems to be the turning point. And especially with Manchester City taking up a large share from 2016 onward, that march has been very steady. But even if you take Manchester City out, you still see a steady rise across the Premier League.
Michael, it is unfortunately hard to ignore the influence of Pep Guardiola on most things tactical in the Premier League and on this topic especially.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly popularised the use of the fullbacks coming inside. How often they make those underlapping runs, I think is questionable. But to be fair, Kyle Walker does it quite well. I mean, the thing I like about Walker these days is he used to just be considered a sheer kind of pace merchant who always went around the outside and was constantly there. But these days, he seems to really hold his position for like 50, 60 minutes and then just suddenly go on a burst. And the opposition winger is always caught out. He did that a couple of times against Watford at the weekend. I think also in the game against Manchester United a while back. So, yeah, I think probably it's Walker that is doing it, even only a couple of times a game, but often to great effect.
If I've understood John's piece correctly and the buckets, the aforementioned buckets, I think Man City probably great proponents of lateral underlaps, particularly into Walker and Cancelo. In terms of the diagonal underlaps, those more penetrative runs, perhaps. I certainly think of Robertson, not least because there was a very recent example of the goal that Henderson scored against Everton that was used in the piece. But John, we can't just say Pep and Man City to answer every tactical question, easy as it is to do so. Who else should we be thinking about? Who should we be talking about when talking about this increase, this rise in underlapping fullbacks?
How about a Pep disciple in Arteta? Arsenal has has clearly seen this shift, and really it's not just an Arteta thing, because this has been going on for the last seven seasons in a pretty steady pattern at Arsenal. So that they're almost an 80-20 split right now, whereas they were very much on the like 95-5 extreme back as recently as 2016-17. You see a more interesting pattern at Manchester United, who actually were doing quite a lot of underlapping in the early part of last decade. Then they got on the overlapping train late, And in the last four seasons, they've returned to underlapping. So they're on the trend, but they're following a different pattern than everybody else.
Bit late to pressing as well, United, but you know, better late than never.
Crystal Palace, I think, is also interesting. They don't send their fullbacks forward as much as some of the bigger clubs, but when they do, they frequently come inside. They're as high as about a 70-30 split on the completed passes this season. And that, again, has been a steady trend for them over the last 5-6 years. And there's a particular rotation that I highlighted in the article that I liked a lot, where Joel Ward sends a pass out to Olisa on the wing. And then instead of overlapping around Olisa, which you know would have taken a long time because he's starting from pretty deep, what happens is Connor Gallagher from midfield makes the seam run inside out, and gives Olisa a passing option up the wing. And that vacates space in the half space that Ward just runs straight ahead into. So Olisa passes it inside to Ward. Ward bounces it out first time to Gallagher. And now they've got a guy in space on the wing with room to pick out a good cross, just like a fullback overlap would do. But they've done it much faster and more efficiently because of that rotation.
Oh, that's right. Of course, you know, we are focusing on fullbacks here, but most things in football tactics come in partnerships, right? And you know, in this instance, you're normally looking at partnerships between fullbacks and wingers, but not always. Those outside central midfielders as well, like you've mentioned there with Conor Gallagher, can be very involved. I remember discussing a few months ago a Liverpool game where James Milner was playing on the right side of their midfield three, and there were multiple instances of Liverpool building up down the right side with Milner the closest player to the touchline, with Alexander-Arnold inside him, and with Salah, of course, the sort of the most infield of the trio. And that's always, you know, we are just focusing on the movements of the fullbacks here, but the relationships that they have with their teammates are clearly a huge part of this. I must admit, I felt instantly like this would be right up Graham Potter's street, but then I suppose because they, as far as I know, almost always play with three centre-backs, and therefore their wide defenders categorised as wing-backs, perhaps they wouldn't apply to this.
That's right, and same deal with Chelsea. A lot of people are pointing out that sometimes Chelsea's wing-backs will underlap, but that's not in my data set. That was left out of what we looked at in this particular article. I do think that's an interesting tactical issue as well.
Could we tease some big ticket work from you when it comes to wing backs? I mean, it hasn't escaped our attention or anyone's that, you know, the rise of three centre back formations with wing backs is crazy right now across certainly across the English game, and I think all over the continent as well. And you know, maybe we could ask you to, as hard as it is, see if we could get something on those wing backs.
I'm worried that people might get tired of reading about outside defenders all the time, but they really are one of the most interesting positions in the game right now. And yeah, certainly in the Premier League and in most leagues, we've seen a rise of three-back formations in the last few years.
Michael, outside of the top teams, dare I say outside of Premier League teams, we've got to talk about Atalanta here, don't we? Every time I mention, you know, quirky full-back, wing-back play, you always go straight to Bergamo.
Yeah, I think they're really interesting because I don't think their side is formatted in the attacking phase in really numerical terms in the way that we would usually talk about it. As we discussed before, often, okay, it's a 3-4-1-2, but you often have a number 10 who stays in position and a centre-back who stays in position. And then you have almost two diamonds down the flanks. So you have an outside centre-back, a central midfielder, a wing-back and a wide forward, and they almost rotate at will. And of course, at times that ends up with the wing-backs coming inside and scoring a lot of goals. Although they can go on the outside. I mean, Robin Hossens, as we saw at the World Cup, is very effective as an overlapper. But yeah, they're one of the more interesting sides. And I think a few of the better teams in Europe have focused a lot on rotations down the flanks. John mentioned Arsenal under Arteta. I think there's a lot still to be done in terms of their attacking play. But at times we have seen, there was a game, one against Newcastle, where the two fullbacks, Tavares and Tomiyasu, were always coming inside and almost shooting regularly with their weaker foot. It was, I don't know whether it was a planned tactic or whether they were instructed to end up there and they ended up shooting, but they were just doing some crazy things you wouldn't usually see. Whether they counted as underlapping runs, I'm not sure. But yeah, there's lots of interesting kind of rotations going on. Inter last season under Conte were interesting. Their left wing back would often duck inside and go towards goal, whereas on the right, they'd play a little bit more of a usual system. So yeah, that's been a big focus, I think, in terms of tactical evolution in recent years, just the rotations down the flanks.
quite hard for me to imagine there'd be a game plan that would involve trying to get your fullbacks or wingbacks taking shots from outside the box with their weaker foot, but you know,
it didn't work very well. I mean, they improved the second half. They both got assists by staying wide and crossing. So the evidence backs up your feeling there, Ali.
I feel like Tomiyasu's been a great addition to that Arsenal side, and he feels like the sort of player, Michael, who can fulfill many functions. You know, we'll probably always play a right back or right wing back, but within that, you kind of trust him to do a number of different jobs pretty well. That's a nice addition to the Arsenal squad, right?
Yeah, you're right. At times he's overlapped quite well. Quite a few games he's sat as part of a back three with the left back pushing on, and at times he's drifted more in, formed a central midfield kind of Kyle Walker type role in there as well. So yeah, I think he's been pretty solid.
That Robertson assist for Henderson against Everton, which we see at the very top of John's piece. It's astounding, isn't it, really, that, you know, I don't want to bang on about how, you know, how the game's developed and how much we love talking about it. But, you know, it's the left back in a back four. He starts the move with an interception with a defensive line that's probably in front of their halfway line at that point, which is pretty crazy if you think about it anyway. And 10 seconds later, he's the most advanced player in attack, cutting the ball back for Henderson on the edge of the box. I think that probably encapsulates why we certainly think that the role of fullback, wingback, if you will, is worthy of discussion regularly on this podcast. This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. We're talking underlapping fullbacks. We've heard the what and the who, and now a bit of the why, I think. Yeah, Michael, we want to talk sort of theory, I suppose, to a greater extent here. And so we're going to turn to you first up to get the ball rolling. Just give us some top-line stuff on why we're seeing an increase on this type of attacking movement from fullbacks.
Well, I think they're quite hard runs to track. I think if you're a wide midfielder, you naturally run back along the touchline and go with the fullback if he goes. But sprinting back towards your own box kind of diagonally just feels quite odd. And of course, if they switch off for a second, it's not just a fullback going into a dangerous crossing position. It can be them going into a dangerous shooting position or a better crossing position or a cutback position, a position where you can play a dangerous pass on the edge of the box. So that is certainly a reason. And it's probably not many examples in football of where you can open up a channel that almost naturally sends a player driving towards goal. I mean, if you start as a number 10, you're very rarely going to get space opened up that you can just motor into because there's so many players in that position. But maybe it comes back a little bit to what John you know, has written about before with the half spaces, and you know, that is a valuable position to have the ball in for various reasons. But that was another article entirely.
John, the attacking side of the game is clearly the juiciest side of the game. But in the piece, you were very, very clear in not just trying to measure what this does for the increased or decreased chances of a goal being scored from the team with the ball, but also what it meant for defending against transition attacks from the opposition. That's a gigantic part of the game as well that we have to touch on here.
Yeah, I was really interested in the why and what I might be able to measure that kind of indicated how this shift got started and why it's been happening across the league. And so part of it, of course, is on the attacking side. You see with these overlapping and underlapping runs, the diagonals that take the fullback all the way to the touchline tend to lead to crosses almost all the time. You can't shoot from there, right? You're going to get it into the box. But the types of crosses are different. If you get a diagonal pass to an overlapping fullback, he's going to cross from wide. It's going to be in the air. The goalkeeper might catch it, and it's going to be very easy, I think, to counterattack behind the fullback. And we see some of that in the data. On those diagonal overlapping runs, about 12.2% of the time, within the next 15 seconds, the opponent will counterattack into the attacking half on the side where the fullback had overlapped from. And that's more, they counterattack about 11% of the time to the other side. So they do tend to like to get behind that overlapping fullback into the space that is vacated.
Yeah, I found it really interesting, John. And one of the answers that I wanted, which you did go some way to answering in the piece, was if we take each category, diagonal overlaps and lateral overlaps, lateral underlaps and diagonal underlaps, is there a clean way of looking at the data and saying this one helps you create a better quality of chance more often, but leaves you more open to a dangerous transition as a result. Is there, you know, could you definitively, and I guess the answer is probably not quite, say this is the preferred way to go. If you want to go down the data route, this is probably your best option for both on the attacking end and the defensive end.
Yeah, because we're using proxies to measure this, I definitely wouldn't want to say that definitively it is best to make an underlapping or an overlapping run. But I can say that on the passes that we've seen in the past, when the pass is completed to that fullback who's making a diagonal overlap or underlap, the really fun high-risk, high-reward option is getting a fullback all the way up the channel on the inside, like that Robertson example that we looked at, and getting that diagonal ball into where he can make a cutback, because those cutbacks tend to lead to really high-value shots. So underlaps that are lateral passes will lead to shots about as frequently as diagonal passes, but those shots are going to be a lot lower quality, right? So about 2.7% of the time that you complete a pass to a fullback all the way into the box, you're going to get a goal, and that's twice as much as for any of these other three types that we looked at. But on the counterattacking side, you're also going to see the ball come back at you faster and more often on that pass type than the other three.
Michael, as with any and all questions of tactical choices that managers have to make, this comes back to the blanket analogy, right? When you have a blanket, it can't cover all of your body. That's not how blankets work. And there's no perfect tactic that covers all bases. So you have to choose. Do you pull it upwards and do you leave your feet exposed, or do you cover your feet and have a cold head and shoulders? That's what we're talking about here. Do you go for the better attacking option, leave yourself more vulnerable? Do you try and find a middle ground, or do you play it safe?
Yeah, I mean, that's not quite as intriguing as the undertaking debate we had last time about what happens on a car if you on a road if you undertake in a car. I mean, Guardiola was, his original idea for shifting the fullbacks inside was to guard against counterattacks, because he reasoned that if you had two real overlappers who ended up by the corner flags, if he then lost the ball, there was absolutely no chance they could regain the ground to form the back four, whereas if they tucked in into midfield, they had less distance to travel. And I think obviously there's been some attacking benefits that's come from that. I would say more so from Cancelo than anyone he's used in that role previously. I don't remember Alaba and Lahm, great players though they were, being as creative as Cancelo has been for the last 18 months or so. So yeah, there is a defensive benefit to the moving inside. I think there's the difference here is probably as much the difference between a lateral pass and a diagonal pass as it is the overlap underlap, because at the end of the day, if your defenders are going in advance of the wingers, they're not in a prime defensive position. But that's obviously just speaking using a bit of common sense rather than using any data to solve that, to provide the answer to that question.
No, that'll never catch on.
Yeah, so that's right. And we do see that in the data, that while it is high risk, high reward to get a fullback all the way into the box for obvious reasons, having a fullback inside receiving those lateral underlaps is actually the best, leads to the best defensive outcomes. Even, again, if you take City out, because, you know, they're going to warp everything by receiving a lot of these passes and by just generally being really good at defense. But for these other three types, you'll get a counter into your defensive half within the next 15 seconds, about 27-28% of the time. And when you have a fullback making that lateral underlap, it's only going to be about 24% of the time. So that's a significantly better defensive outcome.
I'm all about the diagonal underlaps, I think. High risk, high reward, statistically the most potent of the lot. That's what it's all about. Of course, I actually think, Michael, what kind of came into my head thinking about this, more thinking about it in practice, and even applying it to Sunday League football compared to, as well as looking at John's, you know, brilliant data presentation of it, is, you know, in terms of it being a benefit on the attacking end, you know, we're talking about adding variety. And in very real terms, you know, we're talking about fullbacks, generally whose opposite man will be the opposition winger if the opposition is playing with wingers. Generally, and I am generalizing here, these are attacking players, better going forward than going backwards. And their job without the ball is to track, mark these fullbacks. So traditionally, you know, it's a case of running up and down the wing. It's on a very basic level a question of of work rate, of stamina, and of tenacity, but there's not a huge amount of nuance to, you know, chasing a scampering, overlapping fullback up the line and trying to block the cross, right? But tracking a runner inside, tracking a runner past your central midfield line into your own box at times when you're not used to or comfortable doing that, that has to be a huge part of this, right? It's adding a huge and difficult question to the defensive work of wide players.
Yeah, you're right. And this is probably going back 15, 20 years, but when people first started talking about fullbacks as an attacking threat, sometimes they used to say, oh, one of the benefits of being a fullback is you can see the whole picture. You can see the whole pitch when you're kind of receiving the ball because you just your body shape is oriented in the right position. And I guess that applies to making a run as well. If space opens up in the channel, it's relatively easy for you as a fullback to burst inside into that. Whereas if you're a winger tracking them, there's a turn involved, mm-hmm. you've probably got to be, you know, checking over your shoulder, and you've only got to switch off for a second, half a second. If you're up against Cole Walker, you've got no chance of catching him. So yeah, there's various benefits to it, and it still looks slightly odd to me when I see a real direct underlapping run, because it's just not what we're used to. But yeah, it can certainly be highly effective.
I mean, it makes me think of the overlapping centre-backs of Wilder, where one of the things that we saw caused most problems was the fact that opposition managers, depending on the system they played, they didn't really know who to send to track Basham. You know, did you send your striker all the way back? In an ideal world, sure, but practically probably not. That was causing huge problems. It was like this sort of agent of chaos in their final third that they weren't expecting. And, you know, the deck of cards comes crashing down when you've got a solid structure and you know, the thread gets pulled from it. And, oh God, I'm absolutely full of analogies today. This is really caught my imagination. You can come on more often, John. I also think that the last thing I wanted to posit to you, Michael, and it's something that's fairly... We've become fairly used to in the last decade or so is a result of increased data insight, I think, in the game, is crossing as a means of creating your goal scoring opportunities, probably not the best way or the best approach. We've spoken about it a lot. And again, you know, with this approach, with the fullbacks coming inside, yes, it gives the wingers more to think about. Yes, there's a myriad of other reasons why you would do this. But again, perhaps it asks a well-coached defence a more difficult question than overlapping fullback swings in a cross and hopes for the best. Because the answer to that is often, yeah, all right, do that. That's kind of the lesser of all the evils here.
Yeah, we can probably cross-reference John's article with Tom Orville's article from a few months back about prime crossing positions that was really interesting and showed that, yeah, as you would expect, the value of a cross is different from different parts of the pitch. And I think one of the more dangerous zones he suggested was the kind of half space or the inside channel, kind of the De Bruyne position. But I'd have to go back and check that.
John, any extras that you feel we need to know on this topic? Because once we've finished here, I'm afraid it's a full ban on the phrase fullback on this podcast for at least 1 month.
Well, the main thing that I've been thinking about for the last few minutes is that it really is how blankets ought to work, that they should cover all of you, right? And obviously, in football, that's hard, and that's why we use that phrase. But I think that Guardiola is trying in his way to find a blanket that will cover his whole body. And the inside fullbacks seem to be working pretty well for City right now. You know, staying inside, playing good rest defense, pushing forward up to parallel with the wingers to make those kind of diagonal crosses. That seems to be a good balance for them. And I think that we're going to continue to see more teams experimenting with that in the Premier League.
Is the suggestion that Pep Guardiola might have created the first ever tactical baby grow? Well, what a treat it's been to welcome you on the podcast, John. I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
It's been great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Amazing piece, and so great that we could extrapolate it onto the pod and ask some further questions on it. And hopefully it's been an interesting listen. Michael, I know that talking about fullbacks is your favourite thing, so I think you should be thanking us for this topic. But as ever, thanks for your time and your expertise.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
This has been the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast with me, Ali Maxwell, with the Dennis Irwin, Michael Cox, and John the Big Ticket Muller, as we're calling him now. Get used to big ticket pieces on the Athletic site, written by John. I'm already really excited for the next one at theathletic.com/tactics. If that sounds up your street and you're not already a subscriber of The Athletic, you'll be treated to 33% off an annual subscription for The Athletic. And my appetite is whetted for more of these. Plenty on the agenda in the coming weeks on this podcast, but goodbye for now. Thank you for joining us on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.